Welcome to Stanford University. I'm Catherine O'Brien. Can your organization benefit from effective, ethical, and enduring partnerships? Today we'll hear how social influence makes that possible. Dr. Robert Cialdini, arguably the most cited social psychologist in the world today, outlined 6 principles for bringing about desirable change. Let's listen as he tells how the non-manipulative use of those principles makes the people in your organization feel personally committed to the change.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be here today. Let me just bring up the screen here. As Janice suggested, I want to talk about the psychology of persuasion today. And as you could probably tell from that introduction, I'm primarily an academic. What you might not have been able to tell is that I will always be primarily an academic. One reason is I have tenure. They can't kick me out. The other is that I love it. My job, after all, involves the investigation and communication, exploration of ideas. I can't think of a job description I would rather go to in the morning than that one. At the same time, I do recognize that wholly academic concerns aren't always held in the highest regard outside of the university community. I was at a business conference a while ago where I heard an academic described as someone who's not satisfied by something that's working well in practice until he's tried it out in theory. And then this speaker went on to describe a theorist as someone who's willing to assume anything except responsibility. I think there's a regrettable amount of truth there, so I'm going to try to be different today. First of all, I'm going to do more than talk about the theory of persuasion, the theory of influence. I want to talk about the practice of influence, how it can be that one person can significantly increase the likelihood that another person will say yes to the same thing, the merits of the case identical, in the way that the case is presented. Look, we know that in the modern world we have competitors who have good cases to make. We have good cases to make. The group that's going to get the lion's share of the business are those who can make their good case well. And that's what we'll talk about today. I'm going to leave it to you to have a good case to make, but we're going to learn about how to make that good case optimally so that people will move in the direction of the benefits that you can provide for them. The second thing I'm going to do, besides talking about the practice of influence, is that I'm going to take responsibility for what I have to say. I'll issue a guarantee right now that if you understand and employ the principles of influence that we talk about this morning, you will become significantly more effective agents of influence in your professional environments. Right? Now, these principles that we'll talk about are so fundamental, so universal, that they don't simply apply to your professional environments, although that's where we'll be spending most of our time discussing. They also apply to other contexts in which you find yourself and you want to be influential. They will allow you to be more effective in getting people to say yes to you if they are your friends, if they are your neighbors, if they are your family members. I'll even guarantee that if you understand and use these principles, you will get the most resistant of all audiences to be willing to say yes to you, your children. I'll guarantee you'll get your kids to say yes to you more often, okay? So after crawling out on that limb, let's see if I can come through on that particular guarantee by being specific. First of all, I want to be specific about a particular kind of influence, a particular kind of persuasion that I want to consider. It's compliance. The idea that we're not just interested in changing attitudes or perceptions or opinions. We want to change behavior. Getting people to say yes, it's the science of getting what you ask for. And I don't use this term science lightly. As Janet suggested, the art of persuasion is not the only route to success. There is a science to persuasion. There is a systematic study and a vast body of research, 50 years now, of scientific investigation into what causes people to say yes to requests when they receive them. We'll review what I think are the most important conclusions from that research. So we'll be talking about compliance, getting people to say yes, to do what you want, rather than just to think about it in a positive way. Another way I'm going to be specific is that when I do this program in a smaller group, let's say a half day or a full day workshop, I go around the room and I ask people what they want to get from the time that we have together. And invariably, at least one person says, well, I'll tell you what, Dr. Cialdini, I think the science of influence and the topic of persuasion are inherently interesting. They're engaging issues involved, I'm sure. But I'll tell you what I really want from this day. I want one thing that I can take back to my office and implement tomorrow morning and be more successful as a result. Give me one thing out of this day and I'll count it a success. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you more than one thing right now. I'm going to give you six things right now that you will be able to implement immediately upon going back to your office because they have to do with things that you confront on a daily basis. I will answer the following six questions for you during our time together. Here's the first. If you have two options to present to a client, which should you present first? The more costly or the less costly one? Here's a second question. Is it better to tell prospects what they stand to gain by moving in your direction or what they stand to lose if they don't? Third, if you have a new piece of information, when should you mention that it's new? Before or after you present this information to your audience? Fourth, if you have a product, service, or idea that has both strengths and weaknesses, and what doesn't, when should you present the weaknesses? Early or late in your presentation? Clear answer to this one. Fifth, after someone has praised you, your product, or your organization, what is the most effective thing you can do immediately after you have said thank you? I'm here on campus to write a new book. The book is going to be called Moments of Power, and it has to do with the fact that in the course of social interaction, there are particular windows of opportunity where if you know how to identify that moment and what to fill that moment with, you will become significantly more effective. There is a moment of power immediately after someone has said thank you. What do you put in that moment? I'll tell you when we get to that section. Finally, to arrange for someone to like you and want to cooperate with you, what is the single most productive thing you can do before you try to influence that person to like you and cooperate with you? We'll answer all of those questions. Okay. Let's go back to the first one that we considered. If you have two options to present to a client, which should you present first, the more costly or the less costly one? And I'd like to answer that question, solve that particular puzzle, by solving a different one. It has to do with a mystery. At least it was a mystery to me when several years ago, I encountered a newspaper article about a gift of humanitarian aid, several thousand dollars of humanitarian aid, that had been sent between the countries of Mexico on the one hand and Ethiopia on the other. Now, at the time, Ethiopia could lay claim to the greatest suffering privation and misery in the world because of drought, because of internal wars, because of crop failure. The people of Ethiopia were dying by the hundreds every day. And so their relief agencies were calling out to the rest of the world for medicine, for money, for resources of one sort or another. It didn't surprise me then that several thousand dollars would be sent between Mexico and Ethiopia. When I read further into the article, however, I was shocked to learn that the money had not gone from Mexico to Ethiopia. It had gone from Ethiopia to Mexico to help the victims of the Mexico City earthquake that year. Now, how do we explain that puzzling pattern of human behavior? The way I'm going to do it is in terms of the first principle of influence, the universal principle of influence, all right, that my research has uncovered. I've claimed that there are six laws, basic rules of human behavior that we can use to categorize and understand the motives that get people to say yes to requests. And here's the first one, reciprocation. In all human cultures, there is not a single society that does not train its members in the rule for reciprocation, which says, I am obligated to give back to you the form of behavior that you first give to me. If you invite me to a party, I should invite you to one of mine. If you remember my birthday with a gift, I should remember yours. If you do me a favor, I owe you a favor. And I'll say very simply, in the context of obligation, people say yes to those they owe. You can find evidence of this all around. I like to talk about a particular study in my classes that was done by a sociologist at Brigham Young University a few years ago. One holiday season, he decided to send holiday greeting cards to a sample of perfect strangers around the country. He just went to phone books in different cities, he closed his eyes, he picked the name, and he sent these people a Christmas card. He was expecting some kind of response. He was not prepared for the flood of cards that came back to him from people who didn't know him from Adam. That's how it works on all of us. We feel an obligation to give back to others what they have given to us. As I say, I talk about this in my classes. I had a student a couple of years ago come up after class. This is a little different student than most. She was she's a woman who had raised a family in Scottsdale, Arizona, where I live. She came back to get her degree, and she said, Dr. Cialdini, you have just solved a decade-long mystery in my home. She said, about 10 years ago, we got a Christmas card from some people in Santa Barbara, California, the Harrisons, and I didn't remember any Harrisons in hand. I asked my husband, he couldn't place the Harrisons, and my kids were too young, and she said, with a great amount of effort, I resisted sending them a card that year because I was sure it was a mistake. But the following year, we got another card from the Harrisons. So I sent them a card. We're now in the 10th year of exchanging cards with these people. I still don't know who they are. That's how it works. Now, here's why it works. It works the way it does because every human society that trains its members, every group, every organization that plays by the rules of reciprocal exchange gains an enormous competitive advantage. It is that within that group, whoever needs help, resources, time, attention, staffing, whatever it is, can call on other members of the group who feel free to send those resources because they are not sending them away. Now that's profound. For the first time in evolutionary history, there is no other species that has anything like the idea of future obligation for repayment of gifts and favors and services. For the first time in evolutionary history, it becomes possible for one individual to give resources to another without giving them away. What you get instead is a credit. And now when you need something, you can call on other members of the group whom you have helped in the past, and they are very willing. In fact, they are waiting to help because the saddle of obligation weighs heavy on us, and we want to repay our debts. We want to give back to those who have given to us. It's a manager's dream, this rule. Whoever is needy within the organization, whoever has a deficit, can get resources from others, right, and can feel good about asking for them because they're not being solicitors of information or resources that don't get paid back. They now will pay back. Whoever needs it, that resource is sent, that deficit is resolved within the group. Right? Terrific system. Now, let me finish the story of the woman who came to my office and told me about the Christmas card story. She came back to my office a few months later, and she said, "Dr. Cialdini, I have to tell you the end of this story." She said, "My son, Skip, was applying to colleges this year. He's a very good student, so he got into all of his schools, including his top choice, the University of California at Santa Barbara." She said, "He's such a good student that he was asked to be in their honors program and to come to campus a day early for the honors convocation. Well, his dorm room wasn't ready, so he needed a place to stay in Santa Barbara." And she said, "I thought to myself, who do we know in Santa Barbara? The Harrisons, the Harrisons." So she called him on the phone, and she was the sort of person who didn't just write a Christmas card with a greeting. She would also include a Xerox letter describing what the family had been up to. So the Harrisons knew about Skip since Little League days. They said, "Skip, the Skip man, the Skip meister, of course he can come and stay with us." That's now. Here's the other side of that. Should the Harrisons ever have a son or a daughter traveling across the country who needs a place to stay in Arizona, well, my student and her family have to be willing to live by the rule and give back. But why not? Now they have what the Harrisons need. It's a terrific system. We should not bungle this system away when it's right in our... We should master the art of exchange. Exchange is the initiator that begins relationships that create partnerships, alliances, and allegiances. And it means you should be first. The implication of this is if you want to set the tone for the relationship that you want to engender and cultivate, you act first. Your question when you go into a room where you want to be influential is not who can help me here? It should be whom can I help here? Whom can I genuinely advantage, especially in a business way? How can I promote the business prospects of the people in this room, and they will now want to promote the business prospects of you and your organization? Now, we have to be careful not to fumble this one away. It's easy to do. Let me give you an example. Suppose you go back to your offices after this event, and there's a phone call for you from somebody within your organization, maybe somebody outside of your organization, who you would like to be able to influence in the future. This person needs a favor from you. Let's say she's doing a presentation tomorrow and was working on it and realizes she has a gap in her knowledge. But she thinks that in your files, you have the data that will fill this gap. And she asks you, would you go to your files, get that information out, collate it, get it into a table for me, and get it to me by the end of the day so I can get it into my PowerPoint presentation? Right? Well, you've just come back from this meeting. There are emails, there are other phone messages, there are notes taped to your door, but you say, okay, I'll do it. And you spend 3 hours getting this information. You even drive across town. You get it to this person on time. And the following day, she calls you up to say, thank you. I really appreciate that. And how many times have you heard yourself say in response, don't think anything of it. No big deal. It's okay. Just part of the job. I would have done it for anybody. Sound familiar? Well, you have just fumbled away one of the most powerful principles of influence we have. And you don't want to do that. The whole system works better when people who give also receive in return. Otherwise, they're not willing to give in the first place. You have to be willing to accept what in return for what you have given. So what do you say when that person says, thanks, I really appreciate that. That was above and beyond the call of duty. Well, what you don't say is, yeah, and you owe me one now, Buster. No. That's going to produce resistance and resentment. Here's what I'm going to recommend that you say instead. Oh, sure. Listen, I know that if the situation were ever reversed, you'd do the same for me. You'd do the same for me. See what you've done with that one statement? You haven't dismissed the genuine. You have put people on record. Yes, there was a genuine favor that was done. You haven't overblown it. You've simply labeled it as such. And I will guarantee now, the next time you need a big favor, you can ask this person, and the answer will be significantly more likely yes than no. And you know what else? You can wait a long time before you call in your favor. How do I know that you can wait a long time? I know it by solving the mystery of the Ethiopian aid. When I saw that newspaper report, I was puzzled. And I went to my university library to see if there was another journalist who had written about the gift of aid from Ethiopia to Mexico. There was a journalist who went to the head of the Ethiopian Relief Agency who had commissioned the funds and asked the question that I would have asked. Why did you do this? Your people are dying by the hundreds every day. You're calling out to the rest of the world for resources, and you just took thousands of dollars of your own people's resources and sent them to Mexico. Why did you do this? Well, you have to remember that Ethiopia has a very long-standing and sophisticated culture. And this man is reported to have straightened his backbone and said, because in 1935, when Italy invaded Ethiopia, Mexico helped us. Now, 50 years later, transcending the greatest privation and misery in the world, the rule for reciprocity triumphs. This is not to be bungled away when it is right there in our environments, waiting to be employed. Okay, now, one more thing about this rule. It doesn't just apply to gifts and favors and services. It also applies to concessions that people make to one another in negotiations. If you and I start out with two incompatible positions on some issue, you want this, I want that, and you were to say to me, I'll tell you what, Bob, I'll move from my extreme position over here to a more moderate one. If you make a concession to me, If I'm going to live up to the rule that says I have to give back to you what you've given to me, I have to make a concession in return. I have to meet you halfway. I know that that would work on me. It did work on me. A few years ago, I was walking in front of my university library. I was approached by a young man who was a Boy Scout selling tickets to the Boy Scout circus to be held that Saturday at the local Coliseum. $5 a piece for his tickets. I declined. But before I could walk away, he said, "Oh, well, if you can't do that, would you be willing to buy a couple of our chocolate bars here? They're only $1 a piece." And I bought two of his chocolate bars and immediately recognized that something important had happened because I don't like chocolate. But I like dollars. And he had arranged for me to give the dollars I liked for the chocolate I didn't. I went back to my office. I called a meeting of my research assistants to try to figure out what had happened. And where they devoured the evidence, I want you to know. And we thought that this rule for reciprocation of concessions was at work. He started out with an extreme request, $5 a piece. I said no. He said, "Oh, well, if you can't do that, how about just $1 a piece for what I have to offer?" And I said yes. And we thought, well, maybe this would work on other people besides me. If you're interested in getting people to say yes to a favor, you start out with a larger one, one that they're likely to turn down, and then retreat to the favor you were interested in all along. Is that going to be more effective than just asking for that moderate-sized favor straight away? Well, to test this, we went out onto city streets in the Phoenix, Arizona area, asking passersby for a large favor. We said we were from the county juvenile detention center, and we were asking for volunteers to take a group of juvenile delinquents from the center on a day trip to the zoo. Would you chaperone a group of juvenile delinquents on a day trip to the zoo? The great majority of people under those circumstances declined. Only 17% were willing to do it. But for another group, we began with even a larger favor. Would you be a big brother or big sister to one of the kids down at the center? This would require 3 hours of your time every week for the next 2 years. They blinked, 2 years? I don't even know where I'll be in 2 years. Then, taking our cue from the Boy Scout, we said, "Oh, well, if you can't do that, would you be willing to chaperone a group of juvenile delinquents on a day trip to the zoo?" Under those circumstances, now 50% said, "Where do I sign?" It's the same request. We haven't changed the request. The merits is it's the zoo trip. What we changed was what went first. One more breath. A few more words, and we tripled willingness of people to say yes to a request. Now, notice something about the ethics of this. There was no big brother or big sister program down at the center. We invented that for reasons of scientific curiosity. We were studying this fact. But we don't want to be in that position of dishonestly using the reciprocation principle. But we can use it honestly. How many times is it the case that you have different levels of requests to make to people? You can make a request at this level or at this level. And often we censure ourselves. And they say, "Oh, well, they'll never go for this." And so we ask for the more moderate request. What our data are suggesting is if there are genuinely beneficial requests that you can make at different levels, always start with the larger request. If your argument has been compelling and they say yes to that larger one, there is frosting on your cake. Give people a chance to say yes to you. But if the answer is no, now you can retreat to the more moderate request and significantly increase the likelihood that they will say yes to you. Remember I said there was a moment of power after people say thank you to you? There is another moment of power after they say no to you. It's a moment we hate, And as it's human for us to retreat from that situation, because it's self-damaging when people say no to us. Typically, we leave, we reconsolidate our energies, we think about another thing to say, and maybe we come back a week later with a concession. I'll tell you that you have missed the moment. There's evidence to show if you come back a week later, it's perceived as you're there making another request, whereas if you make that concession in the same moment, it's perceived as a concession. And in the context of concession, people want to reply positively with a concession of their own. So here's a little heuristic. If someone has said no to you, if you retreat from the situation, you lose. If you retreat in the situation, you win. Okay, now, let's go on to the next principle that I want to talk about. It's the principle of scarcity. Another universal principle of influence. People want more of what they can't have, right? What they can have less of. Here's my favorite example. I like it because it's a mistake that was made by one of the most effective and successful marketing organizations of all time, the Coca-Cola Company. Do you remember what happened back in the late 80s when the Coca-Cola Company took something away from us that we had normally been used to, the taste of the classic Coke, the old Coke formula, and they supplanted it with the new Coke, right? And they thought this was going to be a great success, right? Because in blind taste tests, the majority of people liked the new Coke more than the old Coke. But let me read you what Time Magazine, which calls this the marketing debacle of the decade and one of the worst 100 ideas of the century, says happened. When Coca-Cola announced that it was changing the taste of the world's most popular soda, it failed to foresee the sheer frustration and fury that the news would create. From Bangor to Burbank, from Detroit to Dallas, tens of thousands of Coke lovers rose up as one to revile the suddenly sweeter taste of this new beverage and to demand their old Coke back. My favorite example of this is personified in a man named Gay Mullins, a retired real estate investor in Seattle, who became a national celebrity by issuing anti-new Coke buttons and t-shirts, setting up a hotline for disgruntled and depressed callers, threatening to bring a class action suit against the company to make the old cola recipe public. He organized the Old Cola Drinkers of America, whose aim was to bring back the beloved soft drink at any cost, and it did not matter to Mr. Mullins that in two blind tests, he expressed a preference for the new Coke over the old. It didn't matter because it wasn't the merits of the thing. It was the context in which the thing was placed. In the context of scarcity, people want what they can't have. What are the implications for you in this regard? It means that when you present an idea, a product, a service, a recommendation, you need to explain to people what it is about this that will give them something that they can't get anywhere else. Now, sometimes it's not one single thing. Sometimes it's a bundle of advantages that they will not be able to get unless they move in your direction. And let me tell you one other thing about this. When you describe these benefits, it is not sufficient to describe what they will gain from them, because the psychological research is very clear. People are more motivated by the idea of losing something than of gaining that very same thing. Anybody here from Santa Cruz? Anybody have connections to Santa Cruz? Okay, a few of you. There was a study done at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Researchers went door to door with a power of official from PG&E, who gave each homeowner an energy audit told them how to put insulation, weather stripping in their homes to reduce the loss of energy. And half of these people were told, if you fully insulate your home, you will be able to save 50 cents a day. The other half were told, if you fail to fully implement these actions, you will lose 50 cents a day.